Forum. Very glad to have you here. We do this about three or four times a year. This is an open question forum with Dr. Hugh Ross. And there is a microphone back there. And Dave is next to the microphone. And Dave does a great job managing that microphone. Everybody say hi to Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Dave's going to decide whether you get to go to the mic or not, so a $5 bill will help. No, I'm kidding. We do this three or four times a year, and we do it in pairs. So we are here today at 11:15, and if you have friends that wanted to come or want to do this again yourself, we're going to be here again tomorrow night at 7 at the church, but not in this room. We're going to be doing the Skeptics Forum tomorrow night in room 154, which is the room just east of us across that alley, right in the direction I'm pointing. So if you can't get enough of it today, please come tomorrow. We'll be going till about 1 o'clock. At noon, we are going to take a break, and we will have a drawing for some RTB material. We call them cash-like prizes. And the lovely Diana over here, everybody say hi to Diana.
Hi, Diana.
And Colleen at the book table.
Hi, Colleen.
And don't ignore Dan. He's, yeah. All right. We have books of Dr. Ross's and RTB's over there at the book table. We have lots of goodies and food over there, and I just want to say an anonymous thank you to all the people who brought that food. So let's put our hands together and say thank you. This Skeptic Forum is co-sponsored by Paradox Sunday School Class and the LA Chapter of Reasons to Believe. Paradox Sunday School Class, if you are not familiar with it, is a Sunday school class here at SMCC that meets every Sunday at 11:15. Also in room 154, where we talk about science and faith and philosophical issues. And the more we know about science and the more we know about the Bible, the more they seem to agree. It's an amazing thing. This is a Q&A. We hope you brought some good questions. Dr. Ross will open us with some of the latest scientific discoveries that speak of the God of the Bible. But as soon as we get some people back at the mic, he will stop and we'll go to the questions. So there's a couple of rules about going to the mic. You may ask as many questions as you like. But please, if you have more than one question and there are people in line behind you, please ask your question and go to the end of the line. And wait your turn. That's well said, Steve. Thank you. And a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He is the founder and president of Reasons to Believe. Reasons to Believe is a organization that also talks about how science and faith come together. Dr. Ross is the author of about 14 books, is that right?
15, and I'm just finished a 16th.
Six
on the web saying, we're on the way to finding life in these gas clouds in the universe. Well, it is true, you need this isopropyl cyanide in order to have any hope of making amino acids, but we have yet to find amino acids in these gas clouds. Now, we have found a few of the biological amino acids in a comet. There was a mission a few months ago sent to a comet where they did some spectral analysis on the nucleus of the comet, and they did find a couple of the amino acids. However, you can go on our reasons.org website. You'll see some articles I've written making the point that in terms of meteorites that have crashed onto the Earth, they have found just 5 of the biological amino acids. There's 20 different amino acids that you need to make proteins, and they have found 5 of the 20. However, we're now recognizing that those amino acids are constructed as they come through our Earth's atmosphere and crash into the Earth. We have yet to find an amino acid in a molecular cloud. A few years ago, they announced that they discovered the simplest of the amino acids, namely glycine. But that claim got withdrawn. They said we misidentified the spectral lines. So it's still true that we have yet to find an amino acid in one of these gas clouds, and we yet to find a nucleoside. And while it is true that this isopropyl cyanide is a crucial factor in being able to assemble these amino acids and nucleosides, it's not going to help you with the sugars. And the sugar problem, to me, is one of the most profound barriers to a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life. The nucleosides is where all the attention is focused, but you cannot join the nucleosides together to make DNA and RNA unless you've got sugars. Basically, 5-carbon sugars, what they call ribose. I'll bet you most of you have heard of ribose. Well, ribose is kind of the glue by which you can link together these nucleosides to make these DNA and RNA molecules. And we've not found these sugars anywhere outside of living systems. They don't exist in meteorites. They don't exist in comets. They don't exist in the crust of the earth, except in the case of decay products of once living organisms. And they don't exist in these molecular clouds. And these things are difficult to make, even in the lab. You can make them. So, yes, they have found isopropyl cyanide. They have found it, however, at a low abundance level. And by the way, I'm on record as saying eventually we will find amino acids in these dense molecular clouds in our galaxy, but we're going to find them at parts per billion. And at parts per billion, that's useless for any naturalistic model for the origin of life. Moreover, we have found 5, at most 6, of the biologically active amino acids. The basic amino acids like tryptophan has not been found anywhere outside of living systems. So we're only finding the simplest of the amino acids, and there's 14 to 15 that have not been found anywhere outside of living systems. So, as an astronomer, I'm excited they found this molecule. It's been a 20-year search to find the molecule. They finally found it in the densest molecular cloud, but they found it at a very tiny abundance level. And since no one is yet at the microphone, let me jump to another discovery, which is actually related to this. Because this whole quest for naturalistic explanation of the origin of life is to find the building blocks like amino acids and nucleosides and sugars. And as I mentioned, they're not able to find these things, but also to find a medium in which they can be constructed and in which, you know, life could possibly exist, namely liquid water. And there was a discovery made just a few days ago where they said, we have found that liquid water was abundant even before the solar system formed. But before I finish the news of that discovery, we got someone at the microphone. And that's how you get me to stop talking. Just come to the microphone. So, Ted, what's your question?
Good morning, Dr. Ross.
Morning.
My question concerns the anthropic principle. I've been reading up a little bit about quantum mechanics and the idea of consciousness being active and the idea of the observer creating reality. And the concept seems to be prevalent, and I'm interested in the strong and weak anthropic principles and the participatory anthropic principle and what your thoughts are on those concepts and the idea of the observer creating the reality in these quantum activities that we observe
right
on a very small scale.
Well, I deal with the anthropic principles at the quantum level in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos. I think we got some copies there at the table. I'll try to be brief. What Ted is addressing is the difference between the weak anthropic principle, the strong anthropic principle, and the participatory anthropic principle. The weak anthropic principle is this idea that when we look out at the universe, we see that everywhere we look, we see fine-tuning to make life possible, and especially human life possible. The strong anthropic principle says that the way the physics is set up, the universe must take on these characteristics. And so it's forced upon the universe that it would have these characteristics that would make life possible. The participatory anthropic principle basically exploits the ideas proposed by Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr is a Danish physicist, theoretical physicist, and often considered to be the father of quantum mechanics. So back in the 1920s, he came up with this idea that the observer can actually determine the quantum outcome. So it's observer causal effects. And so that's what's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's because Niels Bohr was headquartered in Copenhagen. But Niels Bohr actually has a Hindu worldview perspective, and so this idea, the participatory anthropic principle, actually has its roots in Hinduism. And in Hinduism, we human beings, as we interact with the universe, actually change the characteristics of the universe. Some even go so far as to say we change it back in time. So what you're doing and seeing today with your eyes and with your senses actually changes the characteristics of the universe even before you were born. So that's kind of the extreme version of the Hindu idea of the participatory anthropic principle. Now, I've got a book in my office which is called 10 Views of Quantum Mechanics. And what it describes is all the different philosophical ways of interpreting quantum mechanics. And physicists widely disagree on these different interpretations. Where they do agree is on the experimental outcomes. They also agree that when we human beings interfere with a quantum experiment, we actually determine the outcome. But it's not as philosophically exotic as you might think. So, for example, if I were to have a coin in my hand, I could take a coin and actually get it spinning very rapidly on the table here. And as it's spinning very rapidly, you do not know when it stops spinning and falls flat whether it's going to be heads or tails. So as long as it's spinning, it's indeterminate what the outcome will be. But as soon as I take my hand and slam the spinning coin, then it's going to be heads or tails. And so it is true that when I slam my hand on the coin, I, quote, determine the outcome. But unless I take my hand off, we don't know whether it's heads or it's tails. But what the Copenhagen interpretation is actually making the point that how we collapse the wave function. So that's kind of what's happening here, a spinning coin, and basically I collapse it and force an outcome. The instrument in which I use to force the outcome will have a participant. So, for example, if I'm looking for waves, that's what I'm going to see. If I'm looking for particles, that's what I'm going to see. And the other component I won't see. But it's a fallacy to think that we human beings, through our powers of observation, are determining the outcome. What the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says is that the causality is hidden. But if we interfere, then we force the outcome. But it's still true that there's an uncertainty built in as to what we're going to get. And by the way, that uncertainty is crucial for life to exist. That uncertainty is the heart of, say, transistor technology, where with certain situations, the electrons are going to jump over the barrier, other cases they won't, and you need that quantum uncertainty for some to go over, but not all. If it wasn't for the quantum uncertainty, none of the electrons would get over, or all of them could get over. But for our electronics to work, it's important that there be a statistical variation in how many jump the barrier. Your human body is loaded with transistors that need that quantum uncertainty to function. But if the uncertainty value is larger or smaller than what it is, then your transistors will not work the way they should, and you will die. So when it comes Thanksgiving Day next month, you might want to thank God for the fact that if you measure very precisely the energy level of the quantum particle, its uncertainty is about plus or minus a third of a mile. And if it were more than that or less than that, then you would die. And so the universe must be uncertain to a particular degree. But it's a mistake to think that our powers of observation actually mean that we are the creators of the quantum outcomes. The truth is that because we interfere, like with the spinning coin, we do indeed force the outcome. And there's another anthropic principle you see in my book. It's called the final anthropic principle, which is the idea that our powers of observation actually go back in time, like Hindus suggest, go back all the way to the beginning of the universe, and we human beings created the universe, which created us, which caused one atheist skeptic to say this isn't the final anthropic principle. It's a completely ridiculous anthropic principle. But the fellow who invented that has since repented of his completely ridiculous anthropic principle, and in his repentance, he has actually become a follower of Jesus Christ. So, but you want to read about all these different anthropic principles, take a look at the book.
What's the name of the book again?
The Creator and the Cosmos. And you'll see a whole chapter there on quantum mechanics and anthropic principles.
Hugh, I think your next book should be all the things we're supposed to thank God for at Thanksgiving. You've got quite a list.
I've got quite a list, and one of them is not the completely anthropic, ridiculous anthropic principle.
Let me say one more thing I meant to say in my introduction. If you have a really burning question that you want to ask Dr. Ross and you're just shy to go to the mic, write that question down and get it to Dave, and he'll get it to me, and we will ask it.
Yeah, and what you'll see on the screen there is the Twitter address, where literally on a daily basis we keep you up to date on the latest scientific discoveries that give more evidence for the Christian faith, and we give you links to the actual research papers in which these are published in just 140 characters at a swat. So, go ahead.
Susan Howard has a question on the Bible verse, Genesis 1:14. She wants me to read it, and then she's going to ask her question. And God said, "Let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night. Let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and the days and years."
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's not exactly about the verse, but that's the supporting verse for the question, which is about the blood moons. And there's supposed to be one this coming week. And as I understand it, if there are four in a row that fall on Jewish festivals, then the fourth one, something significant happens that affects the world. And a couple of examples are 1948 was one of those when Israel became a state, and the Six-Day War was another one of those four. So it's always the fourth one. The one coming up is the third one, and we're supposed to have one in the spring, I guess, again. I wondered if you had any information or wanted to expand on that in any way. But what interested me was the fact that in Genesis 1, he said he uses the lights and the planets and such as signs for us. So I also was curious if you had noticed other things that are signs like that. That seems so direct, and yet I never heard of that before.
Well, you're referring to some of the best-selling Christian books of the past year. I won't name names, but a number of well-known television preachers have come up with these books on the blood moons and are using them to claim that we're in the time when end times prophecy is about to be fulfilled in certain ways. What is a blood moon? A blood moon is simply an eclipsed moon. And so, when you have a lunar eclipse, what you'll see on the face of the moon is basically earthshine. And because the reflected earth light is going through our atmosphere, it gets reddened. And so when you look at the eclipsed moon, it will look kind of an orange or reddish color. And so that's where the blood moon comes from. And you get two lunar eclipses per year. It's seen by a large number of people. A solar eclipse, you only get like a 70-mile wide swath and maybe 1,000 miles long where people can actually see the total solar eclipse. With a lunar eclipse, typically half the people on planet Earth are able to see it. And so it gets a lot more attention than the lunar eclipses. Now you can get up to 5 solar eclipses a year. You can only get 2 lunar eclipses a year. However, when they talk about the 4 blood moons, that's where you get four, because it can wobble a few days on either side, so there are some years where you get four blood moons within, say, 370 days. And so if you kind of put the calendar the right way, you can actually get basically four in a single year plus a few days. Or you can get three easily within the 365 days. And so what certain people have done is they've looked throughout human history and say, okay, where do we get four lunar eclipses that are close enough that we actually can, you know, if we take the very edges, we can get approximately four in a year. And what these people have done is said, well, every time that's happened, there's been some significant event. Now, here's where I'm skeptical of these claims. There's always significant events in human history. I mean, you can say, well, 1948, that was the birth of the nation of Israel, but other things happened in 1948. That's when Truman left office and we had another president come in. Or that's when you had the Berlin crisis, where the Russians tried to take over West Berlin. So, I mean, pick any year, you're going to have significant events. To me, the proof of the pudding is if they can kind of take their scenario that this is a portent of something happening in the future, actually make some specific prediction. So, you know, I mean, I've heard people say, well, when the planets line up, things are going to happen. Well, the planets have been lining up quite frequently and nothing out of the ordinary has been happening. I would argue that all those times in human history where we had these four moons almost taking place within a year, it's been nothing under the usual. And, you know, people in the past tried to take that stuff and predict future events and they weren't doing too well. So I know these books have sold in the millions, and I know millions of people have watched these shows on television. In fact, when I was on Trinity Broadcasting Network a little while ago, the first question they asked me was, what do you think about the blood moons? And they were quite disappointed when I said, well, I don't think this is anything that we should pay much attention to. So, but they told me I was going to be interviewed about new scientific discoveries that give us more evidence for God, and I wasn't expecting a blood moon question, but fortunately, as an astronomer, I knew enough about these blood moons that we shouldn't worry about it. Now, where you will see a prophecy in the Bible, there is one in Revelation 8, where it says, a time will come in the future in the days before the return of Christ when the sun, moon, and stars will turn color, and they'll take on the color of blood from a corpse. And that happens any time you get a lot of dust in the atmosphere. So if you have some significant volcanic eruption or you've got widespread forests and grass fires, you're going to get enough dust and ash in the atmosphere that when you look up at the sun, moon, and stars, they're going to take on a red color. Those same passages tell us that the light of the sun, moon, and stars will be dimmed by about one-third. And, hey, that happens quite frequently when you have, we have forest fires in the L.A. area. In fact, it darkens by a whole lot more than a third. But evidently, this is a worldwide event. So, you know, that's going to happen in the future, and but exactly how it's going to be pulled off, I don't know. My biggest critique, again, I'm tempted to name names, but I won't name names, of these individuals who are making these statements is, the Bible is quite clear, before any of the end times events they're speaking about, other things have to happen first. And a good place to look is Ezekiel. And by the way, you'll see a thing on our website where I formally respond to the blood moon thing, and I make that point, that these predictions that are being made, that within a few months we're going to be seeing the fulfillment of events that the Bible prophesies will take place, within a few years before the return of Christ to planet Earth, we know that can't happen because there are certain prophecies made in the book of Ezekiel about the modern nation of Israel that have not yet been fulfilled. So until those prophecies are fulfilled, we can't say it's going to happen within a few months. So not all the Jews on planet Earth are living in the land of Israel. Israel is not yet in possession of the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And Israel is yet to become the richest nation on the planet on a per capita basis. Are we close to having those prophecies fulfilled? I think we are. but we're not there yet. And also, it will be a time when Israel as a nation will have no visible arms. So as long as you see them with lots of tanks and fighter aircraft, we're not yet there at that time. Ezekiel chapter 32 through 39 is a good place to go. Okay, another question.
My question kind of has to do with that Ted's question, in that we can't really create an outcome by our observation, but I've got some friends that are more Calvinistic than I am, and after talking to them, I find myself really unable to pray. I'll give you an example. Like, instead of praying, Lord, bless my son as he takes this test and help him to get a really good grade, I will end up praying, Lord, you know whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing for my son to get a good grade on this test. You know whether it's really your will to show him something about himself, like, hey, you're going the wrong direction for your career choice. You need to switch on over here. So, Lord, just do your will on this test, whatever your will is, and put my son on your page. You know, kind of like put us on the same page. Put his father and me on your page that you have for him, and him on your page. Instead of praying, Lord, help my kid do well, I end up praying, thy will be done. Well, then that's okay for a prayer about a test, but I don't feel right when I'm praying, Lord, help nobody to be beheaded in any of these weird situations that you don't want to be beheaded, you know, because there's some verses in the Bible that say that there would be some people being beheaded. So it's kind of like it's interfering with my prayer life, like what if this is the will of God kind of thing.
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, from a Calvinistic perspective and also from the pages of the book of Ephesians, God foreknows everything that's going to happen. He knows everything that's going to happen before he created the universe. And what we see Paul saying in the book of Ephesians, God not only foreknows, he predetermines. So everything is predetermined in advance.
Yeah, why pray?
Yeah, so why bother to pray if God has already decided what's going to happen, when and where? And I would argue it not only applies to action outcomes, it applies to our words and to our thoughts. Now, where you see the most egregious abuse of this is in Islam, where you have Muslims saying, if Allah wills, and they refuse to take any responsibility for the outcome, because, hey, it's all God's will. Now, we are told in Ephesians that God has created good works in advance for us to do. You know, we are saved by grace, not by works, not by anything that we do. And even when it comes to the good things we do do, God has prepared those good works in advance for us to do. And so for what I'm getting at is there. One of those good works may be for you to pray for your son. And so he created that in advance for you to do. And it is true that God has predetermined everything. I believe that that's how to interpret correctly the book of Ephesians. But that before God acts, he waits for his people to pray. And if you refuse to pray for the outcome he wants, he'll find someone else. But here's the problem for you. You lose out on the benefit of praying the way God wants you to pray. What did Jesus say to his disciples? You can pray for anything that you desire, as long as it's in the will of God the Father, and it will be done. Which means our job in prayer is to discover the predetermined will of God. And I think where we Christians can get lazy is that we just say, Lord, I want you to bless my son. And his response is, how do you want me to bless your son? And so you come up with something a little more specific, and he says, no, I want to know exactly how you want me to bless my son. And the whole point is we struggle in prayer to find precisely or exactly what it is God wants to do in that particular situation. We are the ones that receive the blessing. You know, we have a relationship with God that is strengthened, and now we gain the mind of God. That's what it tells us in Romans chapter 12, that what the Holy Spirit is trying to do through us is so that we can gain the mind of Christ. And we do that through prayer life, trying to determine. So, for example, when I've been praying for friends that I know that are not yet Christians, I pray for them to receive Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. But the Lord always comes back to me and says, how do you want me to do it? Who do you want me to bring into the life? What do you want me to have them say? What are the circumstances? And so I prayed for 30 years, for example, for my parents to come to Christ. But it was through praying very specifically about how God was going to use certain people in certain circumstances in their life that finally they did come to Christ. And it also gave me some understanding as to why God had them wait that long. Because there were other people he was going to influence through those different encounters. And by the way, I won't name any names, but some of the people responsible for my parents coming to Christ are actually sitting in this room. And it was Kathy and I just praying for those individuals in this room in the particular meetings they're having with my parents that they would have a particular outcome. And that was a crucial step of their coming to faith in Christ. So that's just simply an example. You know, God has predetermined everything, but he wants us to participate with him in that outcome.
So it's okay to pray, Lord, help my son get a good grade on this test, and then if he gets a bad grade and God uses that to show him you're on the wrong career choice path.
That would be appropriate.
Okay.
And also, you know, help my son get a good grade. God's going to come back to you and say, how do you want me to help him to get a good grade? And maybe you need to be praying about that. He would gain some certain study habits or whatever. So, and this is why it says pray without ceasing. It doesn't mean you repeat your prayers over and over again. That, again, is what you see the Muslims doing. They just say the same prayer over and over again frequently. Rather, we begin with a general prayer, and then we pray again for the subject. We get more and more specific. So that's what the concept pray without ceasing is all about, is that we gain greater clarity as we are developing a relationship with the Holy Spirit about exactly what God intends to do. And hey, if you don't pray appropriately, he'll find someone else. But hey, you miss out.
Okay.
One other thing I want to say, another thing I forgot at the top, was we're having the drawing in about 10 minutes, but to participate in the drawing, you need to fill out those RTB sheets that you have, each of you, on your table. Yes, thank you, Val. So fill those out, we'll collect them, and based on those, we'll do a drawing for our fabulous cash-like prizes.
Yeah, and please tear it, because the bottom half of that is a gift you can take home with you. It's basically a summary of the best scientific evidences for the Christian faith. And I've been handing those out to people, so feel free to take that and be in prayer about who you can give that to. Okay, next question.
Hi, my name is Dan. I've watched quite a few of your videos on YouTube, various talks you've given at churches around the country. And I've heard quite a bit of what you had to say about, I'm sorry, I don't public speak usually, so the timing of creation. You say you choose to interpret the Hebrew word yom as day to be the fourth definition, the long but finite period of time. I haven't heard you say what you think that finite time is. I don't know if it's similar to the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, 7,000 years per day, or is it like a gravitational dilation, time dilation thing, like Chris Putnam puts forth in his creation is a scientific fact video, you know, where the mass of the entire universe
right.
at the very beginning is so intense and so tight that it from God's perspective it's 24 hours, but from matter's perspective it's 8 billion years, followed by 4 billion, followed by 2 billion, and so on as the gravity, you know, gets less intense. I don't know if you define any amount of time period to each of those
right.
days.
Okay, one place you can go is a couple of us gave the Trotter Prize lectures at Texas A&M. It was Gerald Schroeder and myself. And this is where you get to hear a debate on the days, because he takes the point of view that linguistically these days are 24-hour periods. But he appeals to the equivalent of time dilation so that he can have the universe 14 billion years old, and yet it's all squished into these 6 days we see in Genesis that are consecutive 24-hour periods. Now, I do not take the point of view that time dilation is a factor. I think the time dilation approach gets you into all kinds of both scientific and biblical difficulties. But if you're interested, you can listen to the debate that we had. And what's interesting about the debate is Gerald Schroeder is an Orthodox Jew. I'm a Christian. But there were certain physicists and astronomers in the audience who were atheists. And so we wind up debating not just one another, but debating the atheists that were there at Texas A&M. So that's available at the Trotter Prize website. You can listen to the debate. I think it's also up on our reasons.org website. But one reason why I don't go with a time dilation approach, I think there's strong exegetical evidence that these days are not 24 hours, they're long periods of time. You know, you've heard me say that the Hebrew word yom has four different literal definitions. Part of the daylight hours, like say 3 hours, all of the daylight hours, like 12 hours, a 24-hour period, or a long but finite period of time. And I don't go down the Jehovah's Witness route where they say 1,000 years is like a day. So I don't see these 6 days as, say, a 6,000-year period. That was quite popular for people back in the days of the early church fathers. But I believe that these time periods are considerably longer than 1,000 years. And the passage to which the Jehovah's Witnesses refer is 2 Peter and Psalm 90. Psalm 90, a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. But if you read on, it says 1,000 years is like a watch in the night. And so I believe what Psalm 90 is telling us is that from God's perspective, our time can be arbitrarily expanded or arbitrarily shrunk. Because he's equating 1,000 years with 24 hours and 1,000 years with 3 hours. So it's simply making the point that God marks time differently than we do. But the reason why I believe that the correct interpretation is 6 consecutive long periods of time. Number one, there's no evening and morning for the 7th day. And we're told in 3 other places of the Bible, Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 4, that we're still in the 7th day. Romans tells us the 7th day will persist as long as evil exists. So the 7th day has been around ever since God created Eve. So that makes the 7th day a long period of time. The other thing you notice in Genesis 1 is that it claims that God created the human male and the human female on the 6th day. In Genesis 2, we have God creating Adam first, and quite a bit takes place between the creation of Adam and God creating Eve. In fact, I count 8 different things that takes place between those two creation events. I won't go into all the details unless you want me to, but those 8 things add up to a minimum passage of time of 6 months. And so that means the 6th day, likewise, is much longer than a 24-hour period. Now, people often ask me, how long, then, are the 6 days? Well, if we compare it carefully with the book of nature, the 1st day is longer than the 2nd day, which is longer than the 3rd day, which is longer than the 4th day. But all the days are at least 50 million years long. But the Bible never tells us exactly how old the earth is or old the universe is, but you will find numerous passages that tell us that the earth and the stars are ancient. The hills and the mountains are old. The rivers have been here a long time. In fact, we're studying Proverbs 8 in our Paradoxes class, where you got the second person of the Trinity comparing his eternal existence to how long the oceans have been around, the mountains and the stars have been around. And so if the stars, mountains, and rivers are analogies for God's eternal existence, it means they have to be much, much older than we human beings and the passage of human history. But hey, wait a few months, I'm bringing out a second edition of A Matter of Days. It's a whole book devoted to your question.
Wonderful. wonderful.
And the new edition will have 400 pages, and I've added 100 pages of content. So that'll be coming out in February or March.
Wonderful. Thank you.
After the next question, we'll do our drawing. So why don't you get those cards filled out? And Diana, do you want to collect them? And we'll do the drawing. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, Mr. Ross. My name is Bernd. This is my first time to this meeting, so my question is probably one you've already answered many times. The discovery made by BICEP 2 telescope in Antarctica of possible gravitational waves was huge, I think, in March of this year. It was my understanding that the Planck Observatory telescope was to confirm this through its cosmic radioactive readings. It didn't do this. In fact, I think the conclusion, if I'm not mistaken, is that maybe it's dust within our own galaxy.
Right.
What is the future for trying to determine the origins of the early universe or our cosmos, besides telescopes like BICEP 2?
Well, what BICEP 2 and the Planck satellite and the WMAP satellite are doing is giving us insights on the inflation era of the Big Bang creation event, which is something that happened when the universe was a trillionth, a hundred billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. Now, BICEP 2 is trying to take a slightly different approach on that than, say, the Planck satellite. What BICEP 2 is trying to do is actually detect the gravity waves that would have emanated from that hyperinflation event. If you're not familiar with this, it's the idea that the universe rapidly expanded from the cosmic creation event, and then when the strong nuclear force separates from the electroweak force, this is when the universe hyperinflates, where it literally expands thousands, if not millions, of times faster than the velocity of light for a very short period. And by the way, this is something that's not strange. We see it all over the place in physics. It's called symmetry breaking. And let me give you an example. You can take a bar magnet, and if you heat the bar magnet up, the magnetism will disappear. It will apparently disappear. What's happening is at a high temperature, the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend. But when you cool the magnet, the heat energy and the magnetic energy separate. Well, likewise, when the universe is very young, it's extremely hot. And as it cools, the four forces of physics separate out from one another. But when they separate out from one another, you get these symmetry-breaking effects. And these instruments, BICEP 2 at the South Pole, is trying to detect the gravity waves that we believe would emanate from that symmetry-breaking event. And they published it in March, but they jumped the gun. They really didn't have the signal-to-noise ratio or the systematics worked out well enough to say we have positively identified the gravity waves from the cosmic inflation event. And yeah, you're referring to papers just recently published that said the signal that they thought was emanating from gravity waves is basically coming from the dust that's in the plane of our galaxy. And that's one of the biggest difficulties in looking at the cosmic background radiation, is accurately subtracting off the foreground signal of our galaxy so that you can see the background signal of the early universe. That's always the biggest job. In fact, what happens, say, with a Planck satellite, they collect the data over the course of a year, but it takes them 3 or 4 years to process the data. Why? Because they're trying to carefully subtract off the foreground signal of our galaxy. And so what happened with BICEP 2, they really didn't do the job that they had claimed to be able to give a signal. Now what's happening now is they're collecting more data. And so most of us in the astronomical community believe it's simply a matter of time before BICEP 2 actually detects a true signal of the gravity waves. But they did jump the gun. And it's actually caused the scientific community to get a little stricter on their publication rules. And I actually blame the supernova people. Because back in 1998 and 1999, there were two different groups trying to find the signal of dark energy. And one group jumped the gun. They published their result and said, we have found it. And a year later, the second group said, we really did find it. And so who is going to get the Nobel Prize? And so what they wound up doing is forcing both groups to share the Nobel Prize. But everybody knows the first scientific team to find a signal of gravity waves is going to get the Nobel Prize. And so there's a strong temptation to jump the gun. And the scientific community is basically tightening the bolts down and saying, you're not going to get the Nobel Prize unless you really do have a positive detection that's going to stand up. And so they basically slap the bicep two people on the wrist and say, don't do it again. And likewise, has warned the rest of the scientific community, because there's all kinds of experiments going on to detect gravity waves. In fact, there are gravity wave telescopes that are set up here in the United States. And basically, they've gotten this, because, you know, they're close to finding these gravity waves, but they're being told, do not jump the gun. We've had this happen twice now. We don't want to happen again. Now, in one sense, I would say the inflation event is already a done deal. We don't see the gravity waves, but we see something called the scalar spectral index. And we get that from the polarization signal, the cosmic background radiation. And both the WMAP team and the Planck team have a signal-to-noise ratio on that scalar spectral index that exceeds a factor of 5. And that's usually the standard in physics. If it's more than 5 times above the noise, we think you've got a positive detection. In the case of the Planck satellite, it's almost 6 times above the noise. But I can tell you as an astronomer, I have discovered quasars where the signal was more than 5 times above the noise, and it wasn't a detection of a quasar. It turned out just to be noise. Okay, what does it mean? If you got 5 times above the noise, that means 99,999 times out of 100,000, it will be a correct detection. But one time out of 100,000, it'll be just noise. So even 5 times above the noise doesn't really mean absolutely for certain we got a detection. But the fact that we got 2 different instruments that have both found the scalar spectral index signal of the inflationary hot Big Bang event tells me that we really do have experimental evidence that this really happened. But we don't yet see the gravity waves. And what's it going to take for us to actually have a detection of gravity waves? Probably another year of data from BICEP 2, or if we get lucky and see 2 neutron stars merge together to become a black hole, the gravity wave telescopes will pick up that signal. So everybody's waiting for that. However, I would ask you, please pray that we don't see that up close. Mm-hmm. If we see that up close, mm-hmm. we'll get more than just a detection of gravity waves.
Can I just follow up question real quick?
Yeah.
One of Planck Observatory's observations was 3 things: dark energy, dark matter, and known matter. Is dark energy a current day form of expansion because it's permeable and fills in the gaps with all the galaxies? The reason I ask this is I think this is God's way of maintaining our universe without it becoming too chaotic. Is that a form? Is that the kind of an engine that's driving the inflation today?
Yes. I mean, you can't really blame the inflation on dark energy or exotic dark matter or ordinary dark matter. That's a separate issue. The inflation comes from this separation of the strong nuclear force from the electroweak force. So that's an independent issue, but you're onto something. Namely, that the quantity of the dark energy and the quantity of exotic dark matter and ordinary dark matter, those 3 quantities must be extremely fine-tuned in order of any possibility for life in the universe. For example, dark energy and dark matter determine how rapidly the universe expands. Matter tends to slow down the expansion of the universe. Dark energy tends to speed it up. But if you want the planets and the stars that are going to make possible the existence of life showing up at the right time in the right place, it's critical that you fine-tune both the quantity of dark energy and the quantity of dark matter. In fact, if you were to ask me as a scientist, Where do we find the most spectacular evidence for fine-tuning design for the benefit of life? Dark energy ranks first, and the quantity of dark matter ranks second. The fine-tuning exceeds the best example of human engineering fine-tuning design by a factor of 10 to the 98 times. And so I would argue that's one of the strongest pieces of evidence that it's a personal God that shaped the universe for the benefit of life. And I write about that and why the universe is the way it is. So the numbers and the documentation you'll find in that book.
Okay, it's time for the drawing. What we have... Question?
And for those of you who didn't win, you have to go to the table over here. Go ahead.
Question. I was reading a little bit about Stephen Hawking's positing that gravity is really the engine that brings about the universe. And I think that he based that on his coming up with a factor of imaginary time to say that if he plugged his factor of imaginary time into the equations of relativity concerning gravity, he could make the math extend past, you know, the second of zero into the before the origin of the universe. However, I think it's also true that if you use that same factor of imaginary time, that if you take the universe's start moving forward, that imaginary time factor would also destroy the universe coming into being and expanding the way that we observe that it has. In other words, that imaginary time plugged into the Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism would destroy the universe coming into being. It would negate it. So it's not really valid. I don't understand how he could end up defending this concept of an imaginary time factor any more than Einstein could have defended his cosmological constant. To me, they're very analogous in terms of trying to get around a finite universe, if you could comment to that.
Yeah, you'll see a whole chapter that answers your question in The Creator and the Cosmos. It's basically called A Brief Look at a Brief History of Time. Brief History of Time is a book that Stephen Hawking wrote in which he pointed out the idea of imaginary time. And actually goes back to a paper he wrote with James Hartle, who is a physicist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And if you read the book carefully and the paper carefully, it's a what if. And by the way, a lot of theoretical physics that got published is in the what if category, where they say, we know this isn't true, but what if it were true? What would it look like? And so what Hawking and James Hartle are doing is saying, what if the universe, instead of being constrained by one dimension of time, actually is constrained by two dimensions of time, where we got real time and we got imaginary time? And any of you who've got a degree in engineering or physics has probably taken a course in complex variables, where we basically invoke imaginary dimensions. And it makes our math easier in some cases. But what he is really doing is saying, what if the universe had these two time dimensions? And what he points out is the space-time theorems that he himself was involved in producing actually prove that time has a beginning, and there must be a causal agent beyond time that created the universe. So, yeah, actually quote from Stephen Hawking's original space-time theorem to say, this is showing that a God beyond space and time must have created everything. But it's kind of classic Romans chapter 1, where it says those who are opposed to submitting to the authority of the creator of the universe will say that nature did it rather than God did it. And they begin to attribute to nature properties that only God possesses. And so this is a case where they're saying, well, how about if we take the equivalent of extra time dimensionality that God operates in and apply it to the universe. So they're basically attributing qualities to the universe that only God possesses. And if you read carefully A Brief History of Time, and I kind of show you where to look in my book, you've got to Hawking saying, of course we know that the universe in which we live really is constrained to just one dimension of time. and is constrained to one dimension of time, the universe has a beginning. But he's right. If you're to put a second time dimension on the universe, then that would deliver you from the implications of the space-time theorems. But there's eight different sets of experiments in physics that tell us that time, for us, is one dimension, a dimension that can't be stopped, that can't be reversed. We can slow it down, but we can't stop it, we can't reverse it. And because of that, the universe and everything in it has an ultimate beginning, including the space-time dimensions that are associated with it, which implies there must be an agent beyond space and time that created everything. And the only way out is to put qualities on the universe that the physics tells us it doesn't possess. He's still doing that, and he's come up with a new wrinkle in his book, The Grand Design, where he doesn't mention time, imaginary time. He says gravity did it, which is kind of what you said at the beginning, that if you play around with gravity. But he's no longer doing that because numerous physicists, including a lot of his atheist friends, have said, well, that doesn't help your case, because if you said gravity did it instead of God, where does the gravity come from? So, you know, it begs the question. And so he's been going back to this time idea. But the problem with the time idea, everything tells us that it's a what if. It doesn't really pertain to reality. Well, this is why I say in The Creator and the Cosmos, when you read these books by physicists that are trying to escape a personal God, you got to read everything they say. It's kind of like Lawrence Krauss's book. You know, he says, you know, God's not involved, but if you read far enough in, he says, you know, a deistic worldview is unavoidable. What I see these atheist physicists doing today, rather than denying the existence of a transcendent God, they're trying to claim the transcendent God is not a personal being. But this is where the anthropic principle tells us it's not just a transcendent God, it's also a personal God. And it's not just the personal God of, say, Islam, it's the personal God of Christianity, because of the degree of intimate involvement that we see. And by the way, that's one way to classify the different religions of the world. You've got religions like Islam that say that God is transcendent. You've got religions like Hinduism and Buddhism, which says that God is immanent, which is the idea that God operates everywhere within the created realm. Christianity says he is both. He both transcends the space-time dimensions of the universe and is completely free to operate independent of those space-time dimensions. At the same time, he's intimately involved in every cubic centimeter of the entire universe, which means that also applies to every human being. After all, he knows the name of every star. He knows your name too, and knows everything. In fact, there's a scripture passage which says he not only knows your name, he knows every hair in your head. That may not be a big deal for me, but for many of you it is. Okay, next question.
Could you, good morning, Dr. Ross, I'm Dave. Could you just give me a brief overview for the relationship between the Bible and the scientific method?
The Bible and the scientific method. It's part of my story. I mean, I was taught the scientific method in grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. We got it every year in my Canadian public school education. I didn't pick up a Bible to seriously read it until I was 17. I started on page 1, Genesis chapter 1. And for me, the scientific method leapt off the page. The first step of the scientific method, don't interpret until you establish the point of view. But what impressed me about Genesis 1 is how that's the first thing you see. It first speaks about the universe, but when it gets down to the earth, it very explicitly tells us that the Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters of planet Earth. So that's the point of view from which we're to interpret the 6 days. Step 2 of the scientific method, don't interpret until you also have established the starting conditions. And that's also what you see in Genesis 1, 2. Before it takes you through the 6 days, it says that it's dark on the surface of the waters, the water covers the whole surface of the earth, it's empty of life and unfit for life. So it gives you the point of view and 4 starting conditions. Step 3 of the scientific method, don't interpret and to establish what happens, when, where, and in what order. And that's what you see in the 6 days. It matter-of-factly tells you what happens, when, where, and in what order. And at the end of the 6 days, you get a summation of the final state of planet Earth, and you see how it's different from the starting conditions. What's step five of the scientific method? You want to test your interpretation. Basically, it says, having done those first four steps, then you can form an interpretation, but you want to test that interpretation with other experiments, observations, or in the case of literature, other texts. And what caught my attention about the Bible is, unlike, say, the Mormon scriptures or the Quran or the Hindu scriptures, instead of one, two, or three texts that deal with creation, there's more than 24 texts in the Bible that deal with creation. And in particular, the three that take you through the content of the 6 days. And so that explained to me as a 17-year-old why it is that the scientific method came out of European Reformation theology. It was the Protestant Revolution, or Reformation, that gave birth to the scientific method. And what was happening is that people with a scientific bent noticed every time the Bible deals with a subject of creation, it follows this method. And so it seems like this would be a good method to follow in our scientific experiments and observations. Notice that science did bloom in China, but it was stillborn. It bloomed and it died. Same thing happened in India. Same thing happened in the Arabic world. The 9th century, there was a brief flash of a scientific endeavor, but it was stillborn. It was only in Protestant Christianity that not only was it born, it exploded and has been sustained to this day. So that all the cultures of the world are following the biblical testing method. Hey, if you want to read a lot about this, a theologian by the name of Thomas Torrance, he passed away a couple of years ago, he launched the Scottish Academic Press because he wanted to publish a series of volumes documenting how the scientific method came out of Reformation theology. It's a 28-volume set. So I got a few of the books. I don't have the whole set, but I got the ones that are most pertinent. But does a remarkable job documenting that indeed this has biblical roots. Next question.
My question is about tectonic plates and about the fact that India broke off from a large landmass and it is still moving. Are continents attached to the tectonic plates, or what is the situation there?
Okay, tectonic plates. Yeah, the different continents are attached to different tectonic plates, and typically the tectonic plate is bigger than the continent that you see. So, for example, we got India breaking off from the Antarctic plate, and it moved north towards Eurasia. And the collision happened about 50 million years ago, but the collision was a piece of the plate that was still underneath the ocean colliding with the Eurasian plate that was also still under the ocean. Because with every continent, you get what's called a continental shelf. And so the collision was between the two continental shelves first. And it wasn't until 23 million years ago that the actual above sea level land masses fused together. And so that was the birth of the Himalayas. So the Himalayas are really quite young. And by the way, India is still moving northeast into Eurasia, and the collision will not end until India penetrates another 1,000 miles northeast into Asia. So, and it's the fastest tectonic plate collision that we know of. I mean, at its height, India was moving 20 centimeters a year towards Asia. And so when it finally hit Asia, it was quite a dramatic collision event. And explains why we have mountains as high as 29,000 feet at the juncture of the Indian plate and the Eurasian plate.
But
so,
if the plate is moving, wouldn't there be a gap where it left?
Yeah, I mean, the Indian Ocean is kind of the hole that's left as a result of the separation of the Indian subcontinent from Antarctica and Madagascar. I mean, what happened is India separated from Antarctica. Antarctica shifted towards the South Pole. So only recently is Antarctica actually centered right on the South Pole. And then you have India being attached to Madagascar. It split away from Madagascar about 70 million years ago, headed north at a rapid velocity. As I mentioned, it hit the Eurasian Plate 50 million years ago, 23 million years ago. You got the building up of the Himalayas. Himalayas are still going up at a fairly rapid rate. And we also have the expansion of what's called the Tibetan Plateau. The Tibetan Plateau is the largest plateau on planet Earth, and is getting bigger every year. And it's because of the collision between India and Eurasia that we have what's called a tropical tropical ice cap. Because that collision has been so violent, it's pushed up the Tibetan Plateau to an average elevation of now 4,600 meters above sea level. So even though it's close to the equator, that's high enough up where you get a lot of ice and snow coverage. There's actually, when you get at the, there's actually today, in the middle of an interglacial, more ice stored in the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau than there is in the polar ice cap. So the third largest store of ice on planet Earth is in the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. Number one is Antarctica, number two is Greenland, number three is the Tibetan Plateau, number four is the Arctic ice cap. And by the way, if it wasn't for that equatorial or tropical ice cap, we wouldn't have advanced life on planet Earth today. So something else you can thank God for come Thanksgiving Day is the fact that India had such a violent collision with Eurasia. Go ahead.
Good morning, Dr. Ross. Another question on quantum physics. I understood you to say that while there are various interpretations of quantum physics, they all involve, for the observer or the inquirer measure, a participation role in the resolution of the probability wave.
Well, three of them do, seven of them don't.
Seven? So,
yeah, I mean, if you look at all these different philosophical interpretations of quantum mechanics, you've got what's called the realist school, and then you've got what's called the Copenhagen school, which is the idea that we human beings actually participate in the quantum outcome, but there's several realist views that say that's nonsense. And there's a philosophical debate going on. Those are kind of how you can classify the two camps, but in each camp there are subcategories. And when I said 10, I got a book that describes 10, but there's actually more than 10. So lots of debate on how we philosophically interpret quantum mechanics. No debate on the experimental outcomes.
But the experimental outcomes is what I meant to stress, that the inquirer measure is involved in the experimental outcomes. But I understand there's lots of philosophy all over the place.
Correct.
And that Bohr and Heisenberg and von Neumann and others brought consciousness into this discussion, which is pretty philosophical. But if the experimental outcomes all indicate that the inquirer is involved, wouldn't that support consciousness? And in turn, those people tended to say that this provides evidence against the philosophy of materialism. Would you comment on that?
Well, here's one comment I'll make. One critique I have of the Niels Bohr Copenhagen approach is that they're actually elevating the power of human beings, saying, you know, we have this degree of control over the quantum realm. Where you got people like Heisenberg saying, no, what we have in quantum mechanics is the conclusion that we human beings are weaker than what we thought we We're not stronger. We're not more capable. We're actually weaker in the sense that because of the uncertainty in quantum mechanics, we're not able to see causality at the quantum realm like we can at the macro realm. You know, once you've got a big enough sample of quantum entities, you can integrate over them, and in that case, we understand causality from the beginning to the very end. But once we get down the quantum realm, because of the uncertainty principle, causality is hidden and is always hidden, and we can't probe it. But there are people who look at that hiddenness of the causality and draw the conclusion we are responsible for the causality. And I would argue that's an overstep. It's not that we're responsible for the causality. The truth is the causality is actually hidden from our view. And when we intend to explore the causality, we do the equivalent of collapsing the wave function. And when you collapse the wave function, you're basically getting the quantum outcome that your experimental intrusion forced upon you. So, but it still gives you no insight on the causality. Now, I would argue God understands the causality because he's not limited by space and time. But because we are, that causality is hidden from our view. Not only hidden from our view, it's hidden from our understanding. And because it's hidden from our understanding, this is what's launched all these different philosophical models. I mean, if you can't explore or see the causality, then that means you can speculate about the causality. But it is speculation. We don't have the tools scientifically to nail down the causality. Now, we can see the quantum outcomes, but we can't explore the causality of quantum mechanics. But yeah, there's an excellent book you can get which kind of talks about the two sides in their debate. But I think the realist people have got it right. There's limitations on how far we human beings can go to understand the causality. The uncertainty is real.
Hugh, there's a lot of confusion about this topic, and probably I don't know a lot about it. Just to frame it, obviously, for quantum mechanics, that we observe that only on the subatomic particle level, correct?
Correct.
And also that we've determined also that the quantum mechanics is also finely tuned. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So the
second part, obviously, I have people coming up and telling me, well, because quantum mechanics, we see things popping in and popping disappear, that we can obviously see universes popping in and popping in, then would be totally unscientific, correct?
Well, what I would argue is that, yes, there's uncertainty. The uncertainty leads to, you know, different speculative interpretations of what might be going on about what is impossible for us to understand. But one thing we do know is that quantum mechanics is subject to space and time. And that in terms of quantum events, the probability of the quantum outcome is proportional to the passage of time. And so the space-time theorems tell us that the universe goes back to an actual beginning of time. So if the time interval is zero, the probability of getting a quantum outcome is also zero. That means that quantum mechanics cannot be responsible for the creation of the universe, because the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time, and quantum mechanics can't do anything without time.
Yeah, thank you. I just hear a lot of, obviously, non-believers that want to discredit the Bible, that use this as some magic wand to get away from the laws of physics and God designing the universe, and that obviously is not really true.
Right. And if you want to read something on it, probably the one who's really pushing this at a most popular level today is Lawrence Krauss. He wrote a book called The Universe for Nothing, and the whole book is about the amazing things you can do with quantum mechanics, and he actually is claiming quantum mechanics created everything that we see. And so I provide a critique of that. It's free on our website. Just type in A Universe for Nothing or put in Lawrence Krauss. It will pop up, and you can read it. And it's complex because there are several ways that you can appeal to quantum mechanics. And I credit Lawrence Krauss's, he uses every single way. And so that's why I went to the trouble of offering, I think it's like a 16-page critique, because it's necessary to go through all the different ways. Fundamentally, every quantum outcome requires time. And if the time interval is zero, the probability is zero. Also, The more you get from, say, virtual particle production in terms of mass, the faster it's got to return to the quantum space-time foam. Because that's kind of the biggest argument you hear. They use the analogy of virtual particle productions. We have experiments in physics that tell us that you get these massive particles coming into existence from the quantum space-time foam of the universe. So you got this space-time surface, and it's fluctuating at the quantum level, and some of those fluctuations will actually make massive particles. But the Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us that the particles that you make have to return to the quantum space-time foam before the observer can actually capture the particle, which is why we call them virtual particles, because you can't keep them. We know they come into existence, but there's no way you can grab a virtual particle and keep it. And the more you make, the faster it must return to the quantum space-time foam. If we're talking these virtual particles, the snapback time is much less than a trillionth of a second. Now, if you're trying to explain where the observable universe comes from, the snapback time is less than 10 to the minus 120 seconds. And we've got lots of evidence that the universe is older than 10 to the minus 120 seconds. That's one thing that both young Earth creationists and old Earth creationists agree on. The universe is too old for it to come as a result of virtual particle production.
Thank you. You actually got a question through an email, so I'm going to ask
All right.
you this.
And by the way, feel free to do that. You can text your questions in, and we'll answer them that way. But go ahead.
What are the theological issues regarding black holes and singularities, and how should we address these issues?
Well, the theological issue is that as part of the fine-tuning argument, in order to have life in the universe, it must be a universe where black holes exist. But the black holes have to be a certain size, and they have to be at a certain abundance level. If you got too many black holes, it rules out the possibility for life. If you don't have any black holes, it also rules out the possibility of life. You say, how do you come up with this? Well, there's a fine tuning in what's called the uniformity and the homogeneity universe. The universe must, on large scales, be very uniform and homogeneous in order that you're going to get stars and planets so that life is possible. But if it's perfectly uniform and homogeneous, all you get is gas. You'll never get stars and planets. And so you must fine-tune the uniformity and the homogeneity so that you get galaxies, stars, and planets forming at the right time and the right place with the right characteristics so that life is possible. Now, the fine-tuned result that gives you planets like planet Earth, for example, also require that you get a small number of black holes, some that are the size of a few times the mass of our star, the Sun, and some in the centers of galaxies that are millions of times more massive than our star, the Sun. And so that's one of the fine-tuning arguments, is that the number and the masses of these black holes must be fine-tuned if life is to be possible, especially if advanced life is to be possible. But they're still relatively rare. And also, we know that they have to be black holes. They can't be white holes. A white hole universe is only possible. The universe is more than 10 to 66 years old. So there are no white holes in the universe. There are only black holes. There are no small black holes. The minimum size of a black hole is a few times the mass of our star, the Sun. But they've actually found a black hole that's 9 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. But that's in a really, really big galaxy. A galaxy is more than 1,000 times bigger than our Milky Way galaxy. Hopefully that answers the question.
Go ahead, sir.
All right. Good afternoon, Dr. Ross. I recently started a relationship with a Catholic girl, and I've found out that a lot of people in the Catholic community are just like completely religion one side, science stays away, and no mixing or supporting or any of that whatsoever, and wondering how can I help convince her that, no, this can actually help you support your argument with atheists and show them that God is real.
Yeah, good question. And I would start off by making the point that Roman Catholicism is not a monolith. There's quite a few subsections of Roman Catholicism. There are indeed branches of Roman Catholicism where they say, we don't allow the book of nature or the book of scripture to ever interface with one another. They're two separate realms. That's not the majority view amongst the leaders of the Roman Catholic Church. So at their highest academic levels, they're fully persuaded that the book of nature and the book of scripture significantly overlap. And so, and I get invited to speak to different Roman Catholic universities and, you know, priest groups, and where we talk about these issues. So, and I think that's where the Roman Catholic Church is actually going. Now, of those people in Roman Catholicism who hold the idea that the book of nature and the book of scripture do overlap and concur, there's still a spectrum. You know, most of them would take a theistic evolutionary perspective that, you know, God is involved, but he's involved at a level where it's very difficult, if impossible, to detect how he operates behind the natural processes that are producing the life. But you also have those who believe that God is miraculously involved, not only in the creation of the universe, but in the step-by-step increasing complexity of life here on planet Earth. So, and there's numerous books that have been written by Roman Catholic scientists. By the way, we interviewed Brother Consolmagno. He's head of the Vatican Observatory. And so, for example, the Roman Catholic Church actually employs about a dozen astrophysicists to stay on top of the latest discoveries in astronomy and physics, and they actually sponsor a minimum of two conferences worldwide every year where they invite astrophysicists to deliver papers on the subject of the interface between belief in God and the structure of the universe. So, now, again, many different factions. So hopefully that can help you get started.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question that sort of pertains to possibly where science and supernatural belief meet. Is there scientific proof for the existence of angels and demons outside of what we see in the Bible?
Okay. One area where I think there's widespread agreement is the beginning of the universe. I mean, I would argue that's the biggest miracle any scientist could ever hope to uncover, the coming into existence of all physical reality. And numerous of our books over there talk about that evidence. Specifically with respect to angels and demons, a book I wrote with Ken Samples, our staff philosopher, and a national security expert, Dr. Mark Clark, as Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think we have the book there on the table. And we also have a DVD called The Our UFO Hypothesis. And what we do there is we document the scientific evidence in terms of the UFO phenomena that there is intelligent intervention in the affairs of human beings, and what physicist Jacques Vallée, he's an agnostic physicist, but he says there's intelligence in the interdimensional realm. So as a non-Christian, that's what he's saying, is that in between the space-time dimensions or other dimensions, and there's beings there that are responsible for what we observe in the UFO phenomena. And so we talk about their research, but as Christians, we draw the conclusion that these are indeed angelic beings. And yes, they do live in a different dimensional realm than we human beings do, and they do have the power to enter our dimensional realm, but they can only do so and influence our lives if we give them permission. And so kind of the core of the book is looking at it from a scientific perspective, what happens, what are the permissions that we can do, and what experiments can we do to show that this establishes the operation of these entities. What's interesting is that I know of six physicists, all of whom are not believers in God, who have spent 10 years studying the UFO phenomena, and all six of them conclude that what's responsible for these UFOs are the same kinds of entities that are responsible for what we call demonology. So they all conclude there's a one-to-one correspondence. Now, they may have different ideas on what these demons are and what demonology is, but they say with the UFO phenomena. Now, I'm going to give you an important caveat. I've been processing UFO reports since I was 16, and it's because of my background in astronomy and observational astronomy that I got stuck with that job everywhere I went. But from my experience, 99% of what people report as UFOs is not the handiwork of these transdimensional or extra-dimensional beings that the Bible refers to as angels and demons. Rather, it's just misidentifications. Probably half the UFO reports I processed were a planet or the Pleiades or a fireball. I mean, fireballs are really at the top of the list. I mean, I've actually personally seen meteors coming through the sky where the diameter of the shooting star was four times the diameter of the moon. And, you know, typically when people see something like that, they think it's a UFO. And, hey, it's just a meteor going through the atmosphere. And if you're outside doing a lot of observations, you're going to see one of those things once in a while. So, and then they can actually change direction, leave smoke trails. Military aircraft often get identified as UFOs. Swamp gas is another reason why people come up with UFOs. But there's these close encounters that fall in a different category. And typically in the physics community, we do not call it a UFO unless the observer was closer than 500 feet to the actual event. And so if it's more than that, we just say chances are it's not real or not a real UFO. But if somebody winds up being injured by the event, you know, we take that more seriously. And it was Alan Hynek, an astronomer in the 60s and 70s, who developed a category system. Close encounters of the first kind, the second kind, the third kind. You want to know where these movies get their titles? They actually got it from Alan Hynek. An encounter of the first kind is where you're closer than 500 feet. An encounter of the second kind is where there's actual some damage or injury. And a third kind is where there's claimed communication, written or verbal, between the human being and the, quote, UFO not.
And I'm sorry, what was the name of the person who developed the system?
Alan Hynek, H-Y-N-E-K. I refer to him in our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. So, but only about 1% of what people report as UFOs are what I would call a residual UFO, where it's actually the handiwork of one of these supernatural beings. And here's the proof of the pudding. Close all the invitations that you give to these beings, you'll never have a UFO encounter. This is testable. If you close the doors to occult activity, you will not have these UFO encounters. If you open the doors wide enough, I guarantee you will.
Thank you. Hugh, okay. Can you say what that means, closing the doors? Can you be more specific?
Well, what you'll see in the book is I list 41 different things that qualify as inviting these spiritual beings to come into your life. So, for example, playing with a Ouija board. Having a seance where you're trying to call up these beings. That's one way of inviting these creatures to invade your life. They cannot invade unless you give them permission. Sometimes it's more subtle. There was a couple here in this church who bought a home. They moved into the home and they noticed in one of the rooms different objects were actually levitating. And the temperature in the room was about 10 degrees colder than all the other rooms. So they said, we think that the previous owners had some invitation cards. So we went into the home, and we tried to find. Says maybe there's some leftover, you know, Ouija board in the home, an astrological forecaster. Maybe there's some kind of art tool that's there. So we scoured the home. And it turned out that there was, well, I went into the room and could see a very faint octagonal outline. And I also noticed that if I chipped the paint off, it was midnight blue. I said, you know, midnight blue is a color that's used in seances. So we talked to the neighbors, and they said, yeah, two teenage boys, that was their bedroom, and they were conducting seances in the room. And I said, well, that's a pretty good invitation. What we need to do is find what this octagon was on the wall. And we went into the garage, and there was a pile of lumber on the rafters. We hauled all the lumber down, and there was an astrological forecaster that perfectly fit the octagonal shape on the wall. We destroyed that forecaster. No more spoons self-levitating in the room or anything else levitating in the room, and the temperature returned to normal. So that's an example of, quote, closing the doors. But as I say, it can be subtle in that you're not personally responsible for it. It's someone who left an article. And likewise, in some cases, you can say, I have no open doors in my life, but what about your mother? Now, if it's a relative, and it has to be a close relative, we're simply responsible to agree with God in prayer that the activities they were involved in are displeasing to God. That's enough to close the door. But if you endorse what your grandmother did, that still leaves the door open for you, the grandson. So it's important that you disavow the occult activities of your close relatives, because demons will actually jump generations, but they will not jump the generations unless you give them permission. Now, is that your question?
Yeah, especially with Halloween upon us and all these paranormal...
Can you go to the mic? Thanks.
That actually was a beautiful answer to the question, especially with Halloween upon us and now the teens becoming a little bit more interested in doing some of the paranormal activities. How do you address the fact that some Christian teens have witnessed these events, which I think now that you just answered? Number two, does a blessing of the house negate the demon appearances in something of that nature? And number three, what about some of these historical areas, say Gettysburg, for example, where people have been witness to a number of these apparitions appearing?
Well, that's something we document in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, that there's a strong correlation between the number of these experiences people have and the degree of occult activity in that region of the world. So, for example, when I spoke in the Soviet Union back in 1989 and 1990, it's like I was addressing audiences in some cases where a quarter of them were demon-possessed. And it's because of the level of occult activity. And, you know, every Soviet university had a department of occult physics. That was an era when the Soviets realized that they had a technological disadvantage with respect to the United States. And so they were trying to get a jump on us by developing occult weaponry. And so they actually financed this kind of research. Well, consequently, a lot of their physicists were seeing these UFOs. In fact, I remember doing surveys when I was addressing these audiences of scientists. How many of you have had a UFO encounter? And typically it was a majority. Now, if I were to do a survey like that on an American campus, I might get one hand out of 100. I wouldn't get 50% or 60%. And so what I talk about in the book is, like, you know, France has a much higher degree of UFO encounters than we do, but it also has a much higher degree of occult activity. Equatorial Brazil is another place where you see a lot of these UFO events. So the fact that there's a correlation, again, is evidence about the occult connection. And where that occult connection drops, likewise the sightings of UFOs drop. And what's also interesting is that these UFOs, the ones that are real, most commonly occur at 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads. And not in a place where there's no roads at all, but lonely country roads. And I said, that tells us that something supernatural is going on, because who hangs out at lonely country roads at 3 a.m. in the morning? Astronomers do. That's where we have our telescopes. But what's interesting is when you survey astronomers, a very low percentage have had these UFO encounters. In fact, I know of only two astronomers that testify of having UFO encounters. But knowing them personally, I knew that both of them were deep into the occult. And the rest of us, spending thousands of hours at 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads, we saw nothing. And so that tells us that it's not just who's there, because it doesn't correlate. Something else is explaining what's going on. And incidentally, this changes with respect to time. We document how these UFOs evolve. They evolve in direct proportion to our technology. So before World War II was over, the UFOs were moving at about the speed of sound. They called them Foo Fighters in World War II. But the fighters that were seeing these Foo Fighters were fighter pilots who were into the occult. And now we see the UFOs moving at 25,000 miles per hour, because now we've got technology that moves that fast. So they keep pace with our technology. You go back 1,000 years, they were leprechauns. If you go back 150 years or 100 years, they were dirigibles. Dirigibles moving at 50 miles an hour through the atmosphere. Also, what's interesting about these UFO encounters is when they're of the third kind, where communication is going on, the communication also keeps pace with our technology. 100 years ago, these so-called UFO beings said were visitors from the backside of the moon. And when it became clear to the normal human population that light can't exist on the backside of the moon, they changed their story and said, we're from the surface of Venus. But then when scientific discoveries realized that the surface of Venus is 800 degrees Fahrenheit, they said, no, we're from Mars. Then they said, we're from the moons of Jupiter. Now they're claiming to be from another planetary system. So, and what's also interesting is that the scientific data you see in the UFO encounters, it's always flawed. So it's always at a level that's more advanced than the lay population, but the level of the highest academic endeavor, it's flawed. So it tells you they're on a mission of deception. And that's what's 100% of these UFO encounters, they're harmful and they're deceptive. That's the one that's why we say we're not talking good angels, we're talking fallen angels, because there's always harm involved. Or to put it this way, the very best you're going to come away with if you have a close encounter with a UFO is recurring, terrifying nightmares. What's the worst case scenario? They kill you. People have actually been killed by these UFO encounters. But at the very best, you're going to have these repeating, terrifying nightmares until you close the door to the occult. And I've run into people where that's happened. And they say, you know, how can I get rid of these dreams? And I said, well, you need to close the doors. And when they do that, the dreams go away.
Hugh, we're going to take one more question, but I wanted to say that one of her questions involved blessing the house. If you bless your house, does that in some way help with any possible bad spiritual experience?
Yes. I mean, but let me take you back to the couple that consulted me about the home they just purchased. When they purchased the home, they walked all around the house, they went into all the different rooms, and they prayed. But it wasn't enough. And so that's when they called us and said, there must be something left behind in the home that we need to find. Well, what we did when we went into the house is we said, we're not going to start looking. Because I knew the couple had already looked. They said, we've been into the attic, we've been under the house, we've looked everywhere. And I said, okay, we're going to stop and we're going to pray. So we prayed for about 10 minutes that God would show us the article. Because, you know, we'd already blessed the house, but it was still causing an issue. So I said, God, help us find the article. And the couple insisted that they'd looked everywhere. And I said, well, tell me all the places you looked. And I said, what about the garage? And I said, we've looked everywhere in the garage. And I said, well, what about all that lumber up there in the rafters? Now, it's just lumber. And I said, well, it was about 4 feet of stacked lumber. So I said, we're going to haul all that stuff down. And when we did, we found the article. But I don't think we would have found the article if we hadn't prayed first. So the blessing is really a good thing to do, but I would encourage you, broaden the definition of the blessing. And if the blessing doesn't work, kind of what we said earlier, you know, you pray that God would, you know, bless your son. How do you want him to bless your son? And likewise, you know, you're going around the house and you're blessing it, God may want you to get more specific. And this is a good example where we got more specific. And one reason why God held off on blessing the house is that article could offend visitors that came into the house. So I think he was intent that we find that article and get rid of it. Because, you know, they were believers. Nothing was going to happen to them. But what about people coming into the house that wouldn't be believers?
It's exactly 1 o'clock, but we're going to do one last question. So make the question and the answer quick. And
okay.
We'll pray and go.
Well, I can never get good Christian friends of mine who are also young earthers to come here. I don't know why, but one of their favorite sticking points of people I know is when they go into Genesis 1 in verse 29, and I know you know that verse very well, and their interpretation of it has to do with God saying that he gives us every green tree and plant of the ground for food, and that all his creatures are fed by that. They take that, one, I think that the frame of reference is within the garden, if I'm reading scripture correctly. And God does tell us that he created Adam to the west of the garden and then placed him in it. So I think it's somewhat implicit in the Bible that all of the planet was somewhat different than the environment he created for Adam and Eve in the garden. But could you refute, in a scriptural case, people's interpretation that you had no carnivorous
right.
activity prior to the fall?
Yeah. If you want the long answer, it's in our book, Navigating Genesis, which is on the table there. I'll be really brief. Young Earth creationists use Genesis 1:29, where it talks about taking care of the green plants, because all life feeds on the green plants. And they claim thereby that passage is saying there was no carnivorous activity until Adam sinned. Well, the word there for green plants is the word desheh. And if you go back to creation day 3, you see the word there used as well, where it talks about God creating plants on the continents. And it begins with a generic term, that God created the vegetation. And it's the verb desheh, the same word that you see in Genesis 1:29. And then on creation day 3, it gives you three examples of the desheh. It talks about fruit, seeds, and woody material.
Mm-hmm.
It's not giving you a complete list, but it says these are three examples of the desheh. You also find that word used in the book of Job was referring to creation day 3. And basically it's talking about green plants. And what God is saying in Genesis 1:29 to Adam and Eve, take care of the green plants. I'm putting you in charge of the resources of planet Earth. Manage all those resources for the benefit of all life. But take special care of the green plants, because without green plants, nobody gets to eat. And the point there is, even the carnivores depend on the green plants. If it wasn't for green plants, there wouldn't be herbivores on which they can feed. And so it's the base of the food chain. And therefore, I argue that this is not a text that young earth creationists can appeal to say there is no carnivorous activity until the fall of Adam. And some support for that would be Job 38 and Psalm 104, which explicitly tells us that part of God's creation was to create carnivores. And part of the way that God shows love to life on planet Earth is providing prey for the lion and prey for the raven.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's two things there. Carnivorous activity did exist before the fall of Adam, and that carnivorous activity is part of God's good creation. And without carnivorous activity, the herbivores would have much greater suffering than they otherwise would. And we've seen lots of field experiments to that effect. When you remove the carnivores from the herbivorous feeding animals, the disease rate skyrockets and the death rate skyrockets. The suffering, the death of those animals goes way up until you reintroduce the carnivores. And part of the problem is we have young earth creationists interpreting carnivorous activity in a human context. We human carnivores, when we hunt, we go after the best animal in the herd because we can get away with that. That's not true of lions. When lions hunt, they look for the very weakest member of the tribe, the one that is diseased and at the point of death. And by selecting that diseased animal to kill and eat, they actually protect the health of the rest of the herbivorous population. It also makes sure that the strong and healthy ones are the ones that reproduce. So, and incidentally, some herbivores actually welcome the carnivores. There's actually a video clip you can see online which shows this long line of walruses sitting on the beach and these brown Alaskan bears coming by and hugging each of the walruses. And you say, why are they letting themselves be hugged? Well, what's happening is the bears, by hugging the walruses, figure out which one is seriously diseased. And when they find the one that's seriously diseased, they kill it and eat it, even though all the walruses hanging around could easily chase them off. But the walruses recognize this is the way we can maintain the health of our walrus herd. May not be the best example because walruses themselves are carnivores. They're eating fish. But the whole point is they recognize that this behavior on the part of the Alaskan brown bears is actually to their benefit because they're much bigger than the brown bears. They could easily chase them off, but they don't.
But you would say the strongest scriptural case for refuting that God did not create carnivores and except as a consequence of the fall is in Job, where he testifies in Job that he actually created prey.
Yeah,
and
Psalm 104 and Job 38 both make the point that God created carnivores as part of his creation.
Right.
It's not something that evolved after Adam sinned.
Right.
It was part of his original creation, as part of his very good creation. And by the way, you don't just need carnivores, you also need parasites.
Yes.
Parasites are part of God's good creation. Take away the parasites, things get a lot worse. Likewise, the detrivores.
Yeah.
The detrivores are creatures that feed on decayed organic material. Somebody's got to clean up all that decay. If you leave it around, it's going to cause disease.
Yeah, if it wasn't broken down, it wouldn't be oil now, right?
Right.
We have to end with parasites there. There's another group coming in here. They have a service at 2, so if you have things you want to talk about, please take it out into the hall so that they can come in. I want to thank everybody for coming. Again, if you want to do this right away again, we're doing it tomorrow night, 7 o'clock in room 154. Let's give a hand to Dr. Ross.
Thank you.
And Hugh, would you very quickly give us a word of prayer to finish up?
Sure. And by the way, that's 154 West Sierra Madre Boulevard, if you're sharing that with someone else. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've got to spend together. Thank you, Lord, for the privilege of living in the 21st century, when so much is being revealed through both the book of nature and the book of scripture. I pray, Father, you would give us continuing insight, wisdom, and humility to see your revelation in those two books and help us to put it together. Help us to use it, Lord, in order that we can draw closer to you and help others likewise to form a more loving relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen.